From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
As most students return to school this week from the holiday break, we will walk into a difficult but necessary conversation about school safety. Joining us on the program is Don Denault, attorney for O'Reilly Rancilio, Kim Root, department manager for the Office of School Safety with the Michigan State Police, and Rick Scholes, director of security and crisis management for Warren Consolidated Schools. All this and more coming up. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on School Talks is attorney Don Denault from O'Reilly Rancilio, one of School Talks' supporting sponsors. Welcome to the program, Don.
Thank you, Dr. Livernoy. Happy to be here.
I appreciate it. So, Don, with the increased focus on school safety, justifiably, there's an element to safety that often gets overlooked given the profile of so many other acts of school violence and things like that. And that has to do with the behavior of people who visit the school, whether it's a parent, a visitor, or someone attending a sporting event, and so on. And I think this is a good opportunity to talk about how schools, in addition to having to keep schools safe, also have this obligation to maintain decorum and expectation for visitors who come to either the front office or a baseball game or something. And one of the things I wanted to explore with you was, if a parent comes to a front office at a school and they're justifiably upset about something that happened with their child at school, and in the interaction with the school staff, they kind of lose it a little, right? And they get a bit loud and a bit disrespectful to the point where the staff is afraid. I think in one hand, it creates pressure on the school. We have to do something with this person in order for people to feel safe, especially if there's witnesses and all that goes with that. So the option of trespassing someone, which is a pretty, as we know well, a pretty common term in our judicial system, I guess. What options does a school have in dealing with that unruly parent as it relates to trespassing?
Sure. I think probably the listening audience, at least the public that isn't in the school sector, may think of trespass as, you know, I can't go on my neighbor's property. I can't go someplace I've been told not to go, but my child goes to school here. I have every right to be here. And you do have a right, but that right is limited to the decorum and behavior that the school district expects of you, because at the end of the day, the school district's responsibility is to all of the parents, all of the students, all of the visitors to the school, and their staff. So when a person becomes used a bit, I don't know that it would ever get to a point where it's a bit out of control, but at some point, there are going to be encounters by parents with school officials that go beyond whatever line the school district can safely absorb before it creates a fear of an unsafe environment, or a fear that people aren't going to be protected from what this person might do next. That kind of behavior, especially if it's drawn out or if it's repetitive, can lead to a school saying, you are no longer welcome on school property. And that in itself is another way of thinking of trespass. The school district controls the environment that it's been charged with protecting students in. And at some point, a person may be told, you are no longer welcome here, regardless of whether or not your child is a student here.
And they, in essence, forfeit that right that they have if they are issued a trespass.
Sure.
And in that lens, is the school district obligated to file a report somewhere, or how does it become enforceable if, in fact, a person chooses to violate the trespass order that's been issued to them?
Sure. So, like any other store, business, property, if a person has been told and it's been communicated to that person that they're no longer welcome, either at that specific location or at all locations, that information then is communicated to the police if, in fact, a person refuses to honor that trespass. So, for example, a person is told they can no longer attend football games where their student may be a participant, and that person decides to go anyway. police, the school district itself wouldn't enforce the trespass. It would call the police like any other business would and say, you know, police, this person has been told they're not welcome on school property. They're refusing to leave. We'd like you to enforce the trespassing laws. And the police will come out and do that.
We're currently with Don Denault, attorney with O'Reilly Rancilio, talking about school safety and the obligation of schools to manage what we would consider our unruly visitors, so to speak. So in that scenario where the police respond, is there any obligation on the part of the school to notify the police when the trespass is issued initially?
No, no obligation in advance. The police departments wouldn't even have mostly the ability to track that. It would have to be something that is communicated to the police at the time of the complaint. So person's on site, person has been told either by letter or verbally at that moment that it's time for them to go. They refuse. At that point, that would be communicated to the police that notice has been duly provided. In fact, it would be provided right in front of the officer when the officer arrived because the school official would be saying it to the person once more with the police involvement and intervention.
What if an individual denies ever receiving the notice? It seems like the school district should have a way to prove that they, in fact, were served or somehow delivered that notice. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it comes down to the situation, right? If the person is in the moment being told to leave, prior notice is irrelevant, right? They're being told at that moment, you are no longer welcome here. Maybe you're no longer welcome here because of the prior notice, but you're still no longer welcome here. Or maybe it's because of the current event that's unfolding. Either way, the prior notice proof is not going to be an element so long as the police and whatever prosecutor may be involved can demonstrate that the property owner or the controller of the premises told the person they were no longer welcome and needed to leave.
And you know, you make an important distinction because we know well, public school property is public property, but that doesn't mean you have free rein to do whatever you would like to do on that property, given there's things going on at school, like school. How does that distinction work, say, compared to a public property like a city park in terms of behavior? Would a city have an equivalent ability to trespass someone from a city park?
It would. It would, absolutely. Because, again, there are rules. It may be a public property. It may be a place of public gathering and traditionally thought of that way, more so than a school would be. But even then, there are rules about alcohol, glass, litter, violence, right? And those kinds of rules can be enforced by saying you've engaged in too many rules violations or you're refusing to honor those rules. We're going to get the police involved and you're no longer welcome.
So just because in this example, you're a taxpayer, that doesn't give you license to be unruly, obviously.
Right. And of course, unruly is relative and every school district is going to have a different tolerance. Every situation is going to have a different tolerance level. I think it's a last resort for schools when they have to tell somebody that they're no longer welcome.
I need to take a commercial break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about some different examples to give some context to how and in different ways that people become unruly and what the situation is that drives it. But we'll be back right after this. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again, at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
We're back here with Don Denault from O'Reilly Rancilio talking about trespassing and the obligation for schools to keep things safe, especially as it relates to visitors who come onto school property and basically don't follow the rules. So, Don, before the break, we were talking about some different examples of how people might become unruly. And let's take these three examples. Maybe a parent who's angry at the bus stop, a parent who's emotional at a baseball game, or a parent who is emotional in the front office of a school based on something that happened with their child. Any thoughts on how each of those contexts plays into what a trespass would look like or even warranted?
Sure. I think a school district's tolerance levels will be different based on each scenario you've mentioned. When you think about a parent engaging in hostility or aggressive behaviors with a school bus driver, or the kids on that bus, that I think is probably going to be the trigger point for a school district to say, we can't have a reasoned conversation with you. We're not even there with you. You're engaging in this behavior out there where we can't protect those kids from you. So that's probably going to be one of those trigger point thresholds for a school district to say no more. Whereas a conversation at a school office, perhaps the school is going to have a little more tolerance. They're going to understand you have the emotion, but they're going to try to reason with you. They're going to try to mediate. They're going to try to work with you as a parent until they realize that it's not feeling safe anymore. You know, if it gets to that level, crosses that line, that might be the time for it to end. And then at a sporting event, whether it's a rules violation or whether it's just emotion and aggression, again, that's going to come down to, I think, whether or not the school district feels that more needs to be done to protect everyone else in that environment. And it'll be a case-by-case basis.
And, you know, for anyone who has attended a sporting event that involves young children, like a T-ball game or maybe a seventh grade football game, there are always emotional parents there, especially those who in some ways are living through their child, wanting them to be successful and whatnot. And that's an important distinction in terms of someone's emotional regulation, as opposed to, I'm a parent, my son was bullied at school, and I'm going to come up to the front office and get to the bottom of it. I think those contexts are really important to how and when a district decides to trespass someone from school property. And in that lens, the ability for a school district to enforce a trespass policy, is there any particular process for a school district to end a trespass order that would then let a parent come back on school property?
Yeah, nothing specific exists. It's not really a concept that's defined by the legislature. In my mind, it would be either petitioning and starting with the school administration, asking forgiveness or explaining why it was a mistake to be trespassed or why the behavior itself won't happen again, and working with the school to reinstate privileges, whether it be in full or in part. Similarly, if you did try the court process because you weren't getting satisfaction from the school district, my suspicion is the court would send you back to the school district first to exhaust that avenue before bothering the courts with protesting against the trespass.
And in this example, excuse the misuse of a legal term, but whether a trespass is issued or rescinded is completely up to the school district.
It is.
In this example.
There will be some restraints on that through the law, you know, arbitrary and capriciousness standards, unlawful discrimination standards, limited things and reasons why perhaps it wouldn't be complete and sole discretion. But at the end of the day, the courts are not going to substitute their own judgment for that of school officials in terms of what it takes to keep the community safe.
And when you think about all the different public entities in the state, whether it's a public park, a public school district, a public library, it seems as though all of those entities would have an equivalent level of ability to trespass someone if someone wasn't following the rules. It seems pretty, is that a fair assessment?
Sure, yeah. Just because it's taxpayer funded, just because it's a public entity, public school, public city, public library, none of the college, right? None of that really should affect your ability to understand that they still have control mechanisms in place. They still have rules in place. They still have the right to regulate behavior, especially when you're talking about students and kids and parents and staff and making sure they feel safe and not threatened and hostility is minimized. So, yeah, to your point, all of those types of venues have the ability to say, at some point, your behavior is unacceptable and you can't come back until we can see it being corrected.
And, you know, that example of your behavior not being appropriate, when you go back to our initial point of this conversation, with all of the intense focus on keeping schools safe, whether, like, I would imagine just about every school in this across the state are in some way locked down, right? Even though they're public, you just can't walk in and out of them, whereas maybe 20, 30 years ago you could have. But in this particular time we're living, the intense focus on schools to keep things safe, I think, has driven schools to become more conservative and more likely to trespass people just because of the pressure that's on them to keep things safe. Sort of, let's be safe than sorry. You misbehaved X, Y, and Z, so you're out. That seems, at least in part, a byproduct of the intense focus on schools to keep them safe given all the different tragedies. Would you concur with that line of thinking?
I think so. I think without the ability to tell somebody that they can't come back, the problem itself will never get solved. You know, it's a tool in the tool belt for schools. mostly a last resort, but a tool in the tool belt to say, this is how we're going to resolve the problem we continue to have. The police are going to remove you, and we'll talk again after you finally understand your behavior can't be acceptable at a school.
And from a court perspective, just one last thought on this. When someone is met by the police, that typically is a process that would go through a district court in a particular city, correct?
Correct.
And as far as the district court would be the one that would make the judgment on the trespass, the violation of the trespass, and whatever associated punishment would be handed down. Any thoughts on what some of the maybe first one or two types of things that courts might try to do with someone who has violated a no trespass order?
My feeling is the court is going to respect that the school district wanted this in place for good reason, and that would not be the place to challenge the school district's reasons. This would be only would be a challenge of whether or not they committed the actual trespass. Were they told to leave? Did they refuse? Those are the basic elements of trespassing. And then from there, assuming that the person was found responsible in some way, perhaps the court would honor a school district's wishes in terms of maybe continuing the trespass ban, make it a part of probation in some way. But again, there could be times when the school district works with the court process, the prosecutor involved, to say, we've worked with this parent now and we're willing to forgive because we have an understanding. It just really depends on the individual involved and how willing they are and how willing the school district is to work together to perhaps avoid those criminal consequences.
Yeah, because I think at the end of the day, the school would concur that we would prefer rehabilitation as opposed to some, you know, unrealistic punishment for it, especially given how important parents are in the lives of their children at school, or even a visitor like grandma or grandpa or anybody. So, Don Denault from O'Reilly Rancilio, you have given our School Talks listeners something to think about as it relates to what I would consider is a slightly different tangent to how schools are dealing with school safety. And for obvious reasons, this is front and center for many places as they manage visitors and people who come to schools and associated functions. So appreciate your time today, and most importantly, appreciate your support of the show and, above all, your legal expertise. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Kim Root from the Office of School Safety with the Michigan State Police. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Kim Root from the Office of School Safety within the Grants and Community Services Division of the Michigan State Police. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thank you.
So, in our continued focus on school safety, we've talked to a number of people in schools and supporting agencies about just how critical school safety is for us and just about everyone. And as an opener, I wanted to just give our School Talks listeners something to think about, and that is when we're faced with tragedies, whether it's the awful tragedy in Oxford or what happened at Michigan State University or wherever, people want and call for solutions. And they demand them from any and all who could hopefully provide something. And I think one of the most challenging parts in our culture right now is it feels more reactive than proactive. And I'm very much aware in my time as superintendent, the effort that the Michigan State Police has brought forward to be more proactive in a number of different ways. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to share with our listeners some of those big things that I think are just critically important for schools and especially the students and staff who work in them. So on that note, what would you consider as the primary mission of the Office of School Safety at the State Police?
So first, thank you for the opportunity, because this is a topic near and dear to my heart and near and dear to many hearts. Anybody who has a child or grandchild in schools in Michigan wants Michigan to be a leader in this area. And so that really is the work of the Office of School Safety, is collaborating with organizations around the state, collaborating with schools and law enforcement to really move the needle, if you will, Bob, on this ranging topic of school safety. We know, we both know, that it's not one thing we do, but multiple things that we do to make our schools safer. And that's really my goal, leading a team in the Office of School Safety, is to continue to move that needle and to approach school safety in a comprehensive way, by addressing facilities concerns, addressing training for our staff, addressing funding for school safety initiatives, and then really taking that comprehensive approach and saying, what are we doing from a mental health standpoint for our students? Because our kids need us to invest consistently in this area of school safety. And one of the biggest struggles I think that we've had, not just in Michigan, but across the country, is that reactive notion that you're talking about. Is I use this analogy often when I'm speaking to groups. I talk about it like it's a t-ball game. Have you ever seen a t-ball game when the ball gets hit and it goes a certain direction and every kid on the t-ball team runs to that ball, and that's how they react? And that's how we had been approaching school safety, is a very reactive approach. What I'm seeing now is a more sustained approach on the part of school districts to say, again, it's not one thing we do or two things we do, but multiple things that we do. And so one of the projects that I'm most proud of is the work that we've been doing around behavioral threat assessment and management, because and we're training teams in schools to identify and recognize concerning behavior among kids. Some of those behaviors might be, one week a student is engaged and making eye contact and getting good grades, and a month later, you see that student with their hoodie pulled over their head, not making eye contact, grades start to slide. That would be a situation where a behavioral threat assessment might be a valuable tool, and then get those kids the help that they need. It's really something that needs to become institutionalized in our schools, is having these teams work together to, again, identify concerning behavior, pulling parents when we can, and get students the help that they need when they are exhibiting concerning behavior, because that will make a difference in the long term, and it's a preventative strategy, like I said, that we're very proud of.
And, you know, given your work in behavioral assessment, the recent tragedy where the healthcare CEO was assassinated in Manhattan, it really shines a light on, whenever there is a tragedy, lots of groups come together and in some way collectively say, wow, we missed all these signs, right? Whether they're drawing pictures or posting manifestos or what have you. And one thing I've appreciated about the work in your office is trying to create an assessment that is workable for people in schools, because most of them are not trained psychotherapists and whatnot, and at least gives them somewhat of a toolkit to make a difference in the moment that I think matters the most, which is that tipping point between, you know, is he just drawing a silly picture, or is it something deeper? So in that lens, tell us a little bit about the suite of resources that the office started this past school year. It's a published suite of resources designed to help schools in their operations plans. Tell us about that.
Sure, absolutely. So the first emergency operations plan template and guidance issued in Michigan was first published in 2014. We know a lot has changed between 2014 and 2024 in terms of how we need to both prevent and respond and mitigate critical situations in schools. And so the Emergency Operations Plan suite of resources is really designed to help schools meet that requirement. And it is a requirement in the state of Michigan that every school have an emergency operation plan, public and private, for K-12 schools. Mm-hmm. And so we want schools to be compliant with that. We tried to simplify that with a suite of resources where it's downloadable templates. And then we also worked with the national nonprofit I Love You Guys Foundation to streamline the terminology associated with any type of emergency. So that's, you know, active shooter tends to get all the headlines, but there are a range of emergencies in schools, whether they're weather emergencies, gas leaks, there could be a train derailment that affects a school. And so this suite of resources is designed to help schools respond to any emergency situation. And so in publishing this new set of resources, we also included sections that have to do with reunification, because schools are getting pretty good at executing their emergency operations plans. We still need work in terms of how we reunify families in instances of emergency mm-hmm. situations.
That, in my experience, can be as equally hectic as the emergency itself. So one last thought. One of the things the Michigan State Police started a number of years ago is what we know is okay to say.
Yes.
Tell our listeners what that is and how it provides support to schools.
Absolutely. So the OK to Say program functions in two separate divisions within the Michigan State Police. The tip line itself is actually housed in our Michigan Intelligence Operations Center. And then in my office, the public face of OK to Say is housed. And we do literally hundreds of presentations every year in schools to talk about OK to Say. It's one tool in the toolkit for kids. We would like every student to have a trusted adult they could go to in a situation. But in an event that they don't or they're not comfortable with that, OK to Say is a tip line that provides an opportunity for students and staff and others to report a situation in which they feel threatened or they might be concerned about a fellow student, a friend who might be exhibiting suicidal behavior, for example. And that allows us a mechanism to intervene again and get that student the help they need.
Yeah, you know, in my time as superintendent, we've had a number of OK to Say calls. And while some of them seem not the right use of the phone number, there's always that one time, which we've had several, that turned out to be just the right thing. So if you have to handle a couple of calls that are dead ends, so to speak, to save one or two others, it's certainly a worthy charge. Kim Root from the Michigan State Police Office of School Safety, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll go right into the trenches of a public school district with Rick Scholes from Warren Consolidated Schools. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on School Talks is the Director of Security and Crisis Management for Warren Consolidated Schools, Mr. Rick Scholes. Welcome to the program, Rick.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me today.
Appreciate it. So on School Talks from time to time, we've had conversations with different experts around school safety, whether it's how you secure a building, what kinds of crisis plans you may have and whatnot. And one thing I've known, and you've actually helped me in my career understand this, is the most important part of the chain is the readiness of your staff. You can have all the bells and whistles and all the stuff that goes into school safety, but if your people don't know what to do, it really becomes the weakest link in the chain. And in that lens, I want to talk a little bit today about the kind of training that school staff undergo in response to what we unfortunately call an active shooter. So through your lens, what is the first step in training school staff to respond to an active threat?
Yes, sir. Well, the main thing is, as you know, each school is required by law to have an option-based active shooter protocol. And through that protocol, it's the responsibility of the school district to train their staff and teachers and members. One of the things that gets overlooked is that as sometimes administrators, they pick the protocol, they figure out how they want to train people in it, and they kind of leave it at that. As they've done their part, what's overlooked sometimes is ensuring that our staff members and teachers do feel comfortable with the training they've been given, and we've gone through the entire process with them.
So, you know, you mentioned something I think is really it's really worth drilling down on for a minute. Is in our nation's history, we've had some horrific school violence events, from Columbine to Parkland to, you know, most recently here at Michigan State and Oxford. And when those things happen, people justifiably get scared. They get terrified. And the people who are in leadership positions want to try to help by adopting new laws, passing new requirements, etc. And when that happens, it's done in a particular arena that then has to somehow traverse all the way to a teacher in a classroom. And although that seems linear, it is a substantially complicated process to help someone who, by all accounts, no school staff member ever went to school to have to worry about defending themselves and things like that. And it's just an important thing to remember that when that kind of scary stuff happens, people react and they put things in place that they think will help make it better. And the end result is, how ready is your staff? So from your perspective, who should be trained in a school district, school system per se?
Every single employee, every person that's part of that school district, it's imperative that they are comfortable with and understand the protocols for an active shooter response.
And when you consider, what are some of the staff members that, to your average person, someone might overlook? Say in an elementary school, who might people be not thinking of when it comes to having to the need to be trained?
Right. So when we think about schools, we think about teachers, right? And that is the bulk of where our students spend time with their teachers. But they also have there are a lot of times with the support staffs. We have cafeteria workers. We have people that volunteer as aides and things like that in classrooms. Sometimes we overlook them, and we do our trainings, and we include the teachers and administrators, but we forget the support people, custodial and clerical especially. They're very important. They all play a very important role, and sometimes it's overlooked that they need to actually participate in an actual training training scenarios so that they're confident with their response.
Sure. And, you know, in military terms, you've heard the term tip of the spear.
Yes, sir.
And in many, many cases, when you look at the history of school violence, many times the tip of the spear is the front office secretary.
There's no question about it.
Depending on where and how things unfold. And I think that's important to stop and consider, because there are a lot of different types of jobs and things going on in a school that are so far removed from a teacher in a classroom. And if those people on the periphery don't know what to do, you're back to that point I made about where's the weakest link in this chain. So with regard to training, what are some of the types of training that you would consider are important for teachers and staff?
Well, again, you know, making sure that teachers and staff have the opportunity to participate in a simulated training, such as the annual active shooter trainings that are required by law. There's a lot of anxiety, obviously, with bringing this issue up with people, because it's a very real thing. They didn't sign up to be law enforcement, and they didn't sign up to deal with this, and it's very difficult for them. But they, as a whole, do a great job embracing this, and part of the resistance is, I really believe that teachers and staff members could really benefit from an active shooter simulation put on by law enforcement, because it's a controlled atmosphere. It gives them the opportunity to kind of get the heart pumping a little bit, get the little adrenaline dump, and really understand that this is what's going to happen in real life. I always have a saying, and you know this, and you've heard it several times, that you don't practice your free throws during a game. You have to practice before the game so you know what to do. And this just instills a lot of confidence, I believe, in teachers and staff when they can go through through this and kind of take it a little bit at a time and say, okay, you know, this is normal. This is what's going to happen. When it does happen, they're trained. They're going to react much better.
And, you know, we're currently with Rick Scholes, the Director of Security and Crisis Management for Warren Consolidated Schools, talking about active shooter training in schools. And, Rick, tell us a bit your philosophy, or maybe it's a well-known philosophy for an active shooter. Tell us about the initial objective to get to a safe place. What are the implications of that when something is actually happening?
Yeah, so, you know, we have the options-based response for a reason, because, you know, it's lockdown, it's evacuate, leave the building, or prepare to counter. And those are the three main principles of any kind of active shooter protocol. But the bottom line is to get to a safe place. That's what we really want you to do. If it happens to be at the time to lock down, then lock down and go through the process of barricading the doors and finding your hard corners and turning off lights and things you're trained in. If the best way to be out of that situation is to not be there. So the evacuation portion is very important too. But again, these have to be decisions made by those individuals at that time with the information that they have.
And just as important that is, after an event is over, it's typically not an orderly process, and the responsibility of the school to account for the students requires them to, I believe the term is reunification. Tell us how that would unfold after an event.
Yeah, there's generally two phases to a crisis of this type. You have the initial response, which is our response to the active shooter, the locking down, the evacuating. But once it's neutralized, the second phase comes in is the reunification portion. And this can be actually more chaotic than the first time, because you have people and staff and community members, they're in shock and disbelief, and it's very difficult to try to steer everybody. If you haven't practiced it, reunification with your district, it's very difficult to pull that together and account for students and for anybody that's missing, so we can make sure that, you know, everybody is safe.
And, you know, you've given us a really good, well-rounded perspective on what this means. And I want our School Talks listeners to know, regardless of whether you're a parent, grandparent, or whatever, one thing we've known through studying the research is active shooters typically do not take time to breach a locked door, which is why you hear so much conversation about locking down and getting somewhere safe, because tragically they're attempting to do the most harm as quick as possible, and they're not going to take time to breach a door that's locked. So Rick Scholes, Director of Security and Crisis Management for Warren Consolidated Schools, I appreciate your time and more importantly your expertise here on School Talks. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
I'd like to thank our guests for an informative and important discussion about school safety, including Don Denault from O'Reilly Rancilio, Kim Root from the Michigan State Police, and Rick Scholes from Warren Consolidated Schools. I hope you'll join me in appreciating the work that teachers and all the staff in our schools do on behalf of our children. And that's it for now, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.